Okay, we've been given the word to go ahead. Good evening, everybody. My name's Todd Huntington. I'm the vice chairman of the Southeastern RAC, and just got informed 5 minutes ago that our chairman won't be here, so I get to try to get us through this one tonight. Good thing it's only like two items, so... If you want to, as we go through this, I'm supposed to do the procedures process for the items. The division will make a presentation. Then the RAC will be given a chance to ask questions. After the RAC, then it's the public's turn to ask questions. We ask at that time that you keep it just to questions. Following all the questions, then we'll have the public comments. If you want to make a comment, please fill out there are some cards on the back table. Fill those out and bring those up to myself or Chris. We'll call your name. You'll get 3 minutes for personal, 5 minutes for a group. After the public comments, we'll close those, and we'll go to the RAC comments, and then we'll make motions and vote, that type of stuff. So first thing is to approve the agenda. Any questions about the agenda?
Motion to approve.
Have a motion from Jeff to approve. Do I have a second?
I'll second.
Seth seconds. All in favor? That was unanimous. We got minutes emailed to us a while ago, a couple weeks ago. Everybody have a chance to look those over. Do you remember them?
It was,
The 60 pager or something like that, so I'm sure you had a chance to run through that one morning. Do we have a motion on the minutes? Or any changes to the minutes, I should ask. Okay. A motion?
Actually, I make a motion to the table, and I haven't had a chance to read the minutes, and it's one that interests me, and I would like
Okay.
to.
Okay, we have a motion to table the...
I'll second his motion.
Second by Jeff. That was Wayne that made that, by the way.
The motion is to table what? Discussion or approval?
The approval of the minutes, yeah.
Until the next...
Until the next meeting.
On the next meeting,
right,
correct?
Next meeting.
Okay. Okay, so I have a motion by Wayne, a second by Jeff. All in favor, raise your hand. Passed unanimous. All right, moving right along, we'll have our Wildlife Board meeting updates.
All right. Kevin Albrecht is excused tonight. He's on the mountain. I guess he's helping his friend.
I'm sure he's working.
with an elk hunt. And he called me at 3 o'clock today and said there's too much rain. He's not going to get down. So he was at the board meeting, as was I, for most of it. But I wasn't prepared until a few hours ago to give a report on the board meeting. So if you have any questions, or Mike, Dr. King, if you have anything to add, please jump in and comment or correct anything I might say. So I think it was the longest board meeting we've ever had. It was, of course, the first agenda item was the mountain goats, the mountain goat plan for the Dutton and the LaSalles. It was quite a bit of discussion, a lot of comments from the public, numerous organizations and groups that the board listened to for quite some time. And the board asked many questions to both the biologists and the groups, the sportsmen and the conservation groups that were there that had concerns. After 2 or 3 hours of questions and comments, it was probably more like 3 hours, there was a motion. Well, first there was a motion made to approve the Dutton plan. That was approved as proposed, so up to 125 goats as part of that plan on Mountain Dutton. One of the agricultural reps added to that motion and asked that an advisory group be formed and meet annually to address concerns. The LaSalle plan, a motion was made to accept the proposed plan for the LaSalles that would have up to 200 goats on the LaSalles, and also have this advisory group formed to address any concerns. Dr. King at that point made a motion to postpone the transplant until monitoring can be established and to keep the goats to 1.8 goats per square mile. There was some discussion on that motion, or the amended motion, and that amended motion ended up failing 2-4. Mike King and Bill Fenimore were the ones who voted with that motion that failed. The board then voted to approve the plan, and it passed 4-2, with Bill Fenimore and Mike King voting against that motion. Did I represent that accurately, Mike? Okay.
So it was the plan as the division presented it to the RAC. There was no
correct
change.
Correct. The cougars were then discussed, and that took several hours. I think the board agreed with what was heard throughout the numerous RACs in the state, that the cougar plan is way too complicated, and they definitely listened to the RAC's issues and concerns and recommendations. They did, however, approve the plan as proposed, but part of that amendment, part of that motion, asked the division to reopen the management plan this year and provide a simplified proposal that incorporates unit by unit into next year's. So they want us to come back in a year, I think early next summer sometime, with a simpler plan that incorporates the unit by unit idea. The rest of the board meeting, the motions were to basically accept the division's plans as presented. So the fur bear and bobcat harvest recommendations were approved, as were the waterfowl guidebook and rule. They did move the youth hunt start date is on September 21st. Can't remember if that was a proposed, that was part of the proposal, if the board came up, made, you used a recommendation from Iraq. I'm not sure about that. The military installations permit program was approved. So was the license fee increase, the proposed license fee schedule for fiscal year 2015. The Brian Trimp rule was approved as proposed. And so was the AIS rule. And then the convention permit allocation was approved as presented by the division as well. So that's basically the gist of the board meeting. Any questions or from myself or Dr. King?
Sounds like fun. Sounds like we're going to have a fun meeting next July also then if we revisit the Cougars again. Okay. It looks like you're still up with regional update.
Okay. I think I've met everyone here. If you've forgotten, my name is Chris Wood. I'm the new regional supervisor for the Southeastern region. I lived in Price for the last 7 years as I was the habitat manager prior to becoming the regional supervisor. And so I'm just thrilled for the opportunity to work with the various sections and work with the public and all of our great volunteers and for working with this RAC for years to come. So we've had a few changes the last few months in personnel. People have moved on. Sue Ann Riley worked in our office. She was most recently our support services coordinator. She's worked in our office for probably over 20 years. And so her husband has a job in New Mexico, and so she's moving on to New Mexico. So we've lost her this month. Sean Spencer was our officer in Bullfrog, covered the Henry Mountains. And Bullfrog, and he accepted an assignment to work as a CEO in Utah County. So that position is now vacant. We do have two new officers in our region, though. James Thomas is working in our Emory County district. So the Manti, the south part of the Manti, it's divided in half, I believe. And JD, who's here, has the north half. And is that right, JD?
No,
that's Devin, huh? Devin has the north half. James Thomas has the south half of the Manti, and some other areas as well. TJ, you might recognize his face, especially if you live in Moab. TJ worked for us for, 7, 8, 10 years, something like that. And then in January, he went over to the Grand County Sheriff's Office as a sheriff deputy, and he decided that he missed the wildlife work, so he came back to work for us. So we're happy to have these two new officers in our region. Another thing we did in August, myself and a few of our office staff who are over our licensee program, we went to the Navajo Nation for 2 days, 2.5 days, and we have an agreement with the tribe where we sell them permits. We visit 3 different chapter houses over those 3 days, and we sold. We went there with 200 southeastern region tags and 200 southern tags, and we came. We sold most of them during those 3 days. Our aquatic section has been very busy. A few days ago, they stocked Huntington North Reservoir with 1,000 wipers. They've also stocked over 3,000 tiger muskie fingerlings in Joes Valley. And then the season's kind of wrapping up. So our AIS efforts are winding down a little bit. I should mention one of the successes that I think has happened the last month, at Joes Valley. The water got so low that boats couldn't launch. And so actually the Emory County Irrigation District came up with a way to add on to the boat ramp. They bought some, I believe they're military runways, and they added on to the existing boat ramp so that now boats can back up further down into the reservoir and hit water and launch. And so it's launch at your own risk, and it's probably more smaller boats, but Joes Valley is back up and running for fishermen. And when we had to close the boat ramp, we got a lot of public comments. People really bummed out that they couldn't fish the tiger muskies that were really hot. And so it was great to partner up or actually have Emory County Water Conservancy District do that and serve our constituents. Our conservation outreach program has been very busy as well. We've done a fishing day at the Carbon County Fairgrounds in August. We have a fishing event this Saturday here at the Green River State Park. And then a week later, we have a fishing event at the Huntington Game Farm. This time of year, we also have the state fair is going on up in Salt Lake City. And if you've never been, that building on the left-hand corner, we have a whole building dedicated to wildlife. And in the back of that building, we have a fishing pond. And so it's one of the most popular exhibits at the fair. Our constituents and the public can go in and see these big aquariums full of native and sport fish and learn all about, I think this year the theme is predators. And so it's a really great exhibit. There's everything from fish to there's a scorpion, a live scorpion that kids can look at, and it's in an aquarium. And then there's snakes as well. It's a really fun exhibit. And our law enforcement officers, this is the busy season for them. They're in addition to their checking hunters and anglers. They're also working AIS check stations in the southern part of the state. And then just after our goat transplant, you might have seen this on the news. We were coming off the mountain on Taylor Flat. We ran into, you can see this right-hand corner picture there. It's not very big, but there's a Peruvian sheep herder that's sitting down there on an ice chest. And he had been gored by an elk the previous night. Just kind of a fluke accident. He'd been sitting down on the ground resting, and he heard something in the bushes next to him. And he looked over, and there was a big bull elk. And it startled him, so he jumped up. And when he jumped up, the elk got startled and then attacked him. And so he got gored several times, both from the front of his torso and the back, on his knee. It dislocated his shoulder. Anyways, I was with the crew at the time. I was really, really impressed with our law enforcement officers and their training and their professionalism and their compassion. So they... We had an advanced EMT with us. His name is Ben. He lives in Monticello. He works San Juan County and Grand County. He's a sergeant down there. But he had advanced training. He had IVs. He had oxygen tanks. He bandaged them up. And then the other officers, we had a Spanish-speaking officer as well. Dennis, who lives in Blanding, was a translator. And TJ and Jay Shirley were able to call a helicopter and life flight him into Grand Junction. And so it was a really good feel-good story. It made, of course, statewide news. It was an article in the Salt Lake Tribune, and then the Associated Press picked it up, and it went national and then even international. So it was a really great story. And he survived, I think he's out of the hospital. He was in the hospital for several days, but he was in bad shape. His lung had been punctured, and if he hadn't found us, the outcome wouldn't have been so good for him. Our habitat section is another busy time of year for them as well. This is a busy time of year period for all of our division employees, but we're doing habitat projects in every county in our region. A lot of them are improving winter ranges by removing pinyon and juniper trees, but we're also improving summer range by increasing aspen, and we're doing, we do habitat work for game species and non-game species, riparian areas in the desert and high mountain aspen areas and everything in between. So good stuff's happening. And as you probably saw on the news, last week, the division went to Mount to the Tushers, where we received 20 mountain goats. They were released that same day, and the majority of them released that same day and the following day. And so we have 20 mountain goats now in the LaSalles. We also got, after we left, they had 20 more that came in. As the capture plan was written for, and those went to South Dakota. We received turkeys from South Dakota the last several years, so we have an exchange going on there. We received turkeys, and we gave them 20 mountain goats. And those mountain goats will be in the Mount Rushmore areas, from what I understand. And then we got 10 more for the Mount Dutton. I think there's a transplant going on in a few more weeks from now. I think it's Willard Bay, I think. They're getting goats from Willard Bay to put down in Mount Dutton as well. So, and our biologists also work in the check stations and taking samples for chronic wasting disease. And then this fall, we have youth hunts coming up for chuckers, waterfowl, and pheasants. And then, of course, we're in the middle of a bunch of hunts, big game hunts, upland hunts, and waterfowl hunts are coming up. So we've been really busy with that. And that's all I got. I'll take any questions. Anyone has any questions?
Thanks, Chris. Appreciate it. Sure.
Kathy Jo is the young lady who's been transcribing the minutes. She spent a whole week transcribing the voice recording of the last meeting, and she does a great job. Find the young men and you are great. She tries to recognize each and every voice, and she does a great job.
All right, thank you. What can we do
to
help you? All right, our next item is the fishing guidebook and rule. Drew Paul.
Cushing. Before I get going, I'd just like to say that I always appreciate coming out and presenting these recommendations to the RACs and Wildlife Board. This time of year is pretty exciting for us. I'd like to recognize our Southeast Region Aquatics folks in the audience, and then Roger Wilson, who's our Aquatic Section Chief, and Paul Birdsey, who's my counterpart. Furthermore, I'd like to kind of just go through the process that we've adopted in recent years and let you know that the sport fish side of things, we have important partners that we work with, the anglers. We believe that the sport fisheries in Utah are theirs. We work with them diligently throughout the year, trying to get feedback from them, present our recommendations, let them be vetted through a public process that we're working on right now. So this process actually started in May. It started in April from our regional managers, and then we had an online survey that we sent out to the public, received feedback, adjusted some recommendations, and the final recommendations are what you're going to see today. So, as I said, every year for the past several years, we have a statewide survey that we started in May and ended in June. We asked 8 questions regarding regulation changes, and then one that was a management-specific question about Schofield Reservoir, which I'll give you the results of at the end. And then the last one was just a open-ended question for general comments. Tell us what you're thinking. Do you have any additional ideas or concepts that we should consider? And tell us, what you think of the job we're doing. A total of 1,100, almost 1,200 people participated in this survey, so it was very successful. We were instructed by the Wildlife Board last year to explore a possession limit. What we were asked to do was to look at a multiple-day possession limit for the fisheries in Utah. Other states have a 2-day possession limit, and we didn't or don't at this time, and so we decided to explore multiple options and put that out to the public and get feedback from them and kind of get a feel for what our anglers would like to see in that regard. So we came up with 3 alternative approaches, and we worked with our 5 regional managers and members of the public and some special interest groups that deal with fishing. The alternatives were included in that statewide survey for broader public input and feedback. So what we asked were 3 questions. The first is, how would you feel about, or what would be your support of a possession limit, a 2-day possession limit for all species? And that had a narrow level of support. It was just over 50%. The second question was, would you support a 2-day possession limit for warm and cool water species? So these would be the species that would exclude trout and the salmon species. So that one was just over 10%. And then how would you feel about no change? And that was under 40%. So what this told us is that the public supports change in some regard. They're kind of split on what that change would be. So what we did is we went back to our regional managers and came up with what we thought was a good middle-of-the-ground approach. Basically, what this says is that you can have one additional daily limit of unprocessed fish in addition to fish caught in a previous day. And so if you stayed 2 days, you could have the fish that you caught today and fish from a previous day, which would add up to 2 limits. And the limits that you possess would have to coincide with the limits at the lake you're fishing. We also agreed that there were 2 waters that deserve to be removed from that 2-day possession limit. One is Strawberry, which is our most popular water, and like Schofield, it has a limit on it that's in place to protect it from future rotenone treatments. And what we want to do is be a little provincial with that, see how the rest of the state would respond to this and how the anglers would respond, and then proceed at Strawberry if it was acceptable at that time. But take it just a little bit cautious there. Flaming Gorge was the other one that we have a partner in the Wyoming Game and Fish. They're a huge value, and they manage with us Flaming Gorge. And they don't have a 2-day possession limit. They are exploring it, and in their next rotation of their proclamation, they're going to recommend a 2-day possession limit. But at this time, it didn't seem the correct thing to do to move forward with the regulation that would affect half of Flaming Gorge and not the other half and create a law enforcement nightmare up there. So we'd like to hold off on that. Underwater spearfishing is the next one. We were directed by the Wildlife Board again to work with the anglers and the spearfishermen to try and provide more opportunities to spearfishermen. Like I said, our job is to manage the fisheries. The fisheries actually belong to our constituents, the anglers. There's many different types of anglers, spearfishermen being one of those types. The other thing that I'll tell you is that we also, our job is to manage conflicts and make sure that everybody has an opportunity, but they're all getting along out there, and try and manage those as best we can. So we sat down with a group of spear fishermen and regular anglers in the winter of this last winter. It took several months of discussions and came up with a proposal that is a compromise on both groups. I think, you know, everybody won a little. No one won everything, and that's the thing that goes on with those types of meetings. We really appreciated the input of all the groups, and the time was valuable, and our recommendation of this in the same survey was supported. Just over 70% supported the change, and just under 30 did not support the change. And what was recommended in this group is that the yellow would be new waters, so these would be additions. The white are already existing, but we decided to, in that group, break them up into two categories. One being a year-long pursuit by spear fishermen is January 1st to December 31st. It's for those waters on the left. The fisherman's main concern, the regular fisherman's main concern, was the take of black bass during the spawn. And so as a group, everybody agreed to prohibit the take of largemouth and smallmouth bass, so black bass, from April 1st through the 4th Saturday in June. And the waters in white are existing, waters in yellow are new, but inclusively all of those would all the black bass would be protected during those dates. The last thing was that everybody agreed is that Jordanelle and Lost Creek Reservoir should be removed from the list completely. And this is the last one, just to mention everybody and remind you guys that carp may be taken in any water statewide with a underwater spearfishing gear during any at any water during an open fishing season. There was legislation passed. We have for years have had several years have had catch and kill regulations on fish that are moved illegally. When they end up in a water and we didn't want them there, we put a regulation on that water for that species of fish to not protect them. The legislation was to allow those fish that are illegally moved in waters that they agree with that deem necessary can be wasted. It removes them from that list that are protected wildlife that you need to use for, you know, some beneficial purpose. And so what this does is it allows the Wildlife Board to designate in guidebook or rule where fish can be, you know, catch and killed, which they do already, but then allow anglers to do something else other than take them home if they so choose. So it helps us do our job, helps our law enforcement officers do this job more effectively. So our job, there was the several RACs recommended that we provide some guidance to anglers in how to dispose of those fish if they don't want to take them home. And so the last sentence and then the bullet points below there are just recommendations for how people should dispose of those fish. And so they say, you know, you can dispose of them in the water, basically the lake pal approach, which is puncture the air bladder and return them to the water where they sink to the bottom. Two, bury them on the shoreline so that they're not a nuisance to other anglers at the water where they're caught. At a fish cleaning station, which is where normal people take their carcasses and throw them down and they're disposed of that way. At your residence, so in a garden or in your trash, if you so choose, or in your refrigerator or freezer. And then the last one would be at a location where disposal is authorized by law, so a landfill and so on and so forth. So this will just be a kind of an informational thing this year in the proclamation to assist people with doing the right thing. Now, where disposal would be allowed and what species? The first one, we have common carp, which are taken by spear fishermen, and they're also taken by bow anglers, and many people don't eat carp, and right now it creates an issue with what to do with them. And so we agreed, or we'd recommend that common carp statewide, all waters, common carp can be, you know, allowed to be wasted or disposed of. And then the rest is a result of illegal introductions in waters where those introductions took place. So Blue Lake Tilapia, Deer Creek Reservoir, White Bass Black Bullhead, Flaming Gorge Burbot, Grantsville Reservoir smallmouth bass, Lake Powell striped bass, and Red Fleet Reservoir walleye, and Utah Lake northern pike. And then furthermore, we have had a regulation for catch and kill on the Green, Colorado, and San Juan Rivers. But this is just to allow that same disposal recommendation to take place on fish in the Green River, Colorado River, and those tribs. Now, what's important about those tribs and why they're on there is right now these waters up to a management water in each of those are unfished and unmanaged. And so the problem is when you're floating on the Green River or you're down fishing on the Colorado River, on the San Juan River, you could have a catch and kill in the main stem, and then if you're fishing or camping, you know, where that confluence takes place, like Nine Mile Creek or Range Creek, you could have a catch and kill here and turn slightly and have a statewide limit in the inlet where Nine Mile Creek or Range Creek or any of these tribs enter the main stem. So this is mainly for consistency. It's also to do what's right for the recovery of several endangered species in those waterways. And furthermore, these are in those same tribs that I just mentioned, and I'll explain this a little bit more closely in the next slide. We want to, just for consistency's sake, have the same no limit for channel catfish and then a catch and kill on those fish in the tribs of the Green, Colorado, and San Juan Rivers. And we asked this question again on our statewide survey this spring, and it was largely supported. And, you know, so we had an 80% support, 20% didn't support this change. And this just explains the same thing. This is where those waters would have a catch and kill. So it basically, the Green, Colorado, San Juan Rivers, and those tribs would have a catch and kill regulation and no limit on channel catfish. And this just states the same thing on the Colorado River. And then the last one is the San Juan River and those tribs. Now moving on, the last part of this is just region specific, and I'll go through these fairly quickly. This Brianhead Pond, and for the first time in my life, I learned that there is a town called Brianhead. I thought it was just a pond up in the middle of nowhere, but there's a town. They have a pond in the middle of town, and we have a community fisheries program with a two fish limit on it. As such, this Brianhead Pond, they would like to designate as a community fishery and have the statewide two fish limit on it. The next couple, two, are just really reclaiming regulations that we passed off to state parks in recent years. Actually, it was 3 or 4 years ago. We thought that since they regulated boats and boat motors and where boats could go, that they would, then they have a list where they're legal, where they're not, that they could take this on. The problem is a number of these are actually our regulations, and they did not keep their list updated. It was, it was poorly kept up, and so we decided to take the regulations that we enforce for fishing purposes and put those back in the proclamation. So this first three are just to prohibit boats and float tubes on these three waters: Aspenmere Lake, Duck Creek, Springsville Lake, and Pine Valley Reservoir. And like I said, the next one is just to prohibit boats with motors on these waters. And this is, again, is just bookkeeping. The regulation's already in place. It's just making sure that it's addressed in our proclamation and that we're responsible for it from here on. Southern region, and this is more bookkeeping than anything. Lake Powell, we allow chumming with anchovies at Lake Powell. The strange thing is in our proclamation and guidebook, we allow baits to be used. There's a list of baits, different kinds of fish that you can use in Utah, and the list is, or a partial list is there, Utah suckers, carp, red-sized shiners, and blah, blah, blah. The strange thing is it at Lake Powell, although you can, use those as bait, any of those on that list, you can't chum with them. And as strange as that is, if you have them there at your disposal, it'd be nice to throw some in the water as a chum if they're on your hook. So this is just kind of really making it easier for anglers to use bait down at Lake Powell and assist us in removing striped bass. Northeast region, Current Creek, this is an underutilized stream in the northeast region, and this is just to see if increasing the limit, which was 2 fish, increasing it to 4 might provide a little bit of additional harvest in there, increase the size of the fish in that stream, and increase the pressure and angler satisfaction. Red Fleet Reservoir, this change is the result of the wasting statute which the legislature passed. And what we're hoping is the reason that we didn't have a catch and kill on it previously is it had a mercury listing. It had an advisory for too much mercury, and there were people, and there was a limit on what you could consume safely. And at that time, we felt it wasn't in our best interest to encourage people consuming those fish. And so we just had a no limit. Now that they can dispose of them in other ways, we felt it appropriate to install a catch and kill regulation at Red Fleet. Wasatch Mountain State Park, this is a community fishery, and as such, you know, the 2 fish limit would apply. Hopefully that's what we're recommending. Central region, Yuba Reservoir, we had a work group that we put together with anglers, business owners, state parks, water users. We met every month for over a year, came up with several recommendations and a management plan, which we will follow for the next 5 years. This limit recommendation is part of that management plan. Right now, the limit on Yuba and statewide for northern pike is 10 fish. We'd like to double it to thin them out and then only allow one over 36 inches, which hopefully will incorporate a trophy component of the northern pike fishery at Yuba, which will hopefully increase satisfaction down there and increase pressure on those fish. And we asked this question again on the online survey, and the support rate was 80%. Northern region Lost Creek Reservoir, this has a restrictive regulation like Schofield, Panguitch, and Strawberry Reservoir. As such, we have a limitation or a regulation that does not allow the filleting of trout and salmon. It allows our officers to identify those fish and correctly size them immediately. And the thought is to protect the fishery and allow our officers to do a better job on waters that we're really concerned about. So they would not be allowed to fillet trout or salmon at Lost Creek Reservoir. State Line Reservoir, this fishery, believe it or not, you know, kokanee come and go in booms and busts, and it was thought several years ago that the kokanee fishery up there has disappeared or had disappeared, and those fish stopped running up the river. So we determined that it was no longer advantageous to protect them since they weren't there. Well, lo and behold, they returned in large numbers last year. And it looks like that's going to continue. And so as such, you know, we would like to protect those spawning fish in State Line Reservoir during the spawn. And this had a 90% support rate on that survey. Willard Bay Inlet and Channel. This is just really just consistency. We have a bait section on, it's the one we discussed earlier. Certain species of fish can be used as bait in use in Utah. Other ones can't. Gizzard shad can be used statewide as long as they're commercially sold and preserved. There's some wording in our proclamation that identifies what that is and how it takes place. The strange thing is that we don't allow gizzard shad to be used in any regard or possessed at Willard Bay where, you know, they exist. The thought was at that time that people might pick them up and illegally move them to another fishery and drop them off for us, which would cause an issue. This would allow them to use store-bought gizzard shad, which are available in all your major sporting goods stores, and allow them to be used at Willard Bay, which is, strangely enough, they can use them anywhere else in the state. Okay, these three waters are, there's bluehead sucker and some other native fish in there. And what we'd like to do to protect them and hopefully prohibit the people of taking them home and using them as bait, what we'd like to do is only allow carp to be the only non-game fish that can be taken in the Raft River, Weber River, and Yellow Creek. Electric Lake, this is specific to you guys. This is a brand new kokanee fishery. We stocked 20,000, I believe, in Electric Lake this spring. They're not catchable yet, but they soon will be. when they do run, it would be really nice to protect those fish when they run up the inlets to spawn, and if they're in the reservoir during the spawn, to protect those fish as well. So this would just protect the fish in Electric Lake during the spawn. And once again, we asked this question on the survey, and there was a 90% support rate. This is just a continuation. If they are in the tribs that run into Electric Lake, those fish would spawn if they're left there and create, you know, young fish moving back in and a proliferation of the kokanee fishery. And so this just protect those fish as well. And that, again, had a 90% support rate. We have had a kind of a vague definition of what snagging is for years, and it's created us issues in a number of our waters. Two specifically are Bear Lake and Flaming Gorge, and most recently Willard Bay. And so we worked with our anglers and our regional managers and other states to actually improve the definition of what snagging is. And so this is what we're recommending, that it's unlawful to intentionally snag or attempt to snag any fish hooked anywhere other than the mouth must be immediately released. And then we define snagging as to hook a fish anywhere other than the mouth. And if you do so, then those fish would have to be released. And the only exception to that would be Bear Lake, where snagging is allowed for Bonneville Cisco. And that's it. I promised you one slide on Schofield Reservoir. Schofield Reservoir, as you know, has historically had a chub issue. And we've been, seeing a diminishing return on our rainbow trout. So we have used Bear Lake cutthroat and then tiger trout in recent years to try and reduce those chub numbers and improve the conditions in Schofield Reservoir. And in 2011, a study was undertaken in cooperation with Utah State to determine if those fish are working, and if it's possible to actually drive those chubs down to a point where we can start managing with rainbows again. The question on the survey was, would anglers support a ceasing of rainbow trout stocking to allow us the opportunity to stock more tiger trout and more Bear Lake Bonnevilles in Schofield to speed up that process, to drive those chubs down faster and hopefully turn that around. And 90% of the respondents were in favor of this change, and which is surprising, because believe it or not, most of our anglers, I believe 75% of our anglers, actually prefer fishing for rainbow trout. So this is a real interesting thing. So just thought that you ought to be aware of that. With that, I thank you.
Thanks, Drew. Any questions from the RAC?
Drew, I'm going to start where you kind of ended at Schofield. The fact that Schofield is going to be part of the 2 daily bag limit, how's that going to affect the USU study as far as... is that going to mess up the study design of that study?
I think I'll let Justin answer that.
Okay. Well, the study is pretty much over, and there were only 2 waters statewide. Well, 1 really. That was going to be an exception to that 2-day possession limit rule.
Two waters: Lost Creek and Strawberry.
Strawberry and Flaming Gorge.
That was
for political reasons with Wyoming, until we can get on the same page. We didn't feel like it was going to be a significant problem at Schofield.
Okay, so the reason that I understand the political deal with Wyoming, that Strawberry is just due to the pressure that Strawberry receives. Is that why you feel like a 2 daily bag is not acceptable there?
Yes. Strawberry, historically, and in the survey that we just completed, every 5 years we do a statewide survey for all anglers just to get an idea where the pressure is. And Strawberry is by far our most popular water and receives a lot of pressure, and there was concern about harvest of rainbows mostly.
Okay. And then one last question. When does Wyoming do their regulation change?
Believe it or not, this year. So we're going to wait a year. They have a biannual proclamation, so we're going to wait a year and then hopefully sync up with them year after next. And they have agreed to pursue this in Wyoming, so it isn't kind of a whim. It's we've talked to them, and they're willing to pursue it up there. They tried it once before. It got shot down, but they believe that if we can work together that they can get it implemented.
But isn't it no matter which does it first, Utah or Wyoming, it's going to be offset?
No. Our thought is to wait a year, and then when they move forward with it, we move forward with it as well.
Okay, so it'll come online simultaneous?
Yeah, that's the thought. And just so you know, when this was presented at the Wildlife Board, they kind of forced us to look at this, which was a good thing. We needed to do it anyway. We've been talking about it for several years, this two-day possession limit concept. And in my mind, and when we talked to the anglers, our managers, they agreed what this could do is increase the pressure on the more distant waters, the ones that people go and camp at, provide them incentive to go camp and enable them to take, two limits instead of one. We have seen a real decrease in pressure in those waters in recent years. And so we're hoping that this can, remove some of the anglers from our close waters and push them or allow them some incentive to go to those more distant waters and take advantage of some waters that are underutilized.
Okay. And in the definition, or I guess of the daily bag, there was some just wording on unprocessed. So if somebody is bottling fish in their camper, once they're in the bottle, they're no longer part of a possession limit. Is that what
they are actually part of the limit?
Will be part.
Yes.
So am I reading it wrong then? So it says unprocessed fish. So
yeah. Processed would mean that they're ready for a meal, so that they're going down. So if in your freezer you had a limit, you could go out and take a second limit, and then you're done by this definition. But okay. Bottled fish would count in your limit.
It's processed.
Yeah, I'd be looking at that word because people are going to get confused. Processed, when they pressure can it, they're going to say that's processed.
Yeah, I think we can do that with a definition, and we'll have to do that as to what processed would mean.
Okay. Thanks.
Thanks, Darris.
Any other questions from the RAC?
The only communication I got on this was, I think, someone from Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife who was suggesting, I think, a 3-limit possession.
Yeah, they have, and they will.
Okay. I'm not advocating.
When you guys looked at a 2-daily bag in the effects of the waters, did you evaluate 3?
No. It's important, and this is something for important. It's important for everybody to recognize that there is no 3-day possession limit anywhere that I could find in the fish world. The reason that, at least last night, talking to Ken Strong, who was the guy that recommended it last night, the reason that he presented it was that he wanted it to be consistent with upland game. Upland game has a 3-day possession limit. He thought that it should be consistent in that regard. The problem is if we have a 3-day possession limit, then we're nowhere near anybody in the fish world as far as what's acceptable. So that would be problematic.
Any other questions? Open it up to questions from the public. Seeing none, how about comments from the public? I didn't get.
I do have a letter that was sent to Kevin Albrecht. And is it okay if I read that?
Please.
I'll pass it around to everyone as well.
Brent, can you pass that to
everyone? It says, Kevin, I am the member. I am the chair of the Utah Anglers Coalition. The coalition membership includes Utah bass anglers, Friends of Strawberry Valley, strawberry anglers, Utah Council Trout Unlimited, Salt Lake County Fish and Game, Rocky Mountain Anglers, Federation of Fly Fishers, High Country Fly Fishers, Stonefly Society, and several angling-oriented commercial entities. We have been working closely over the past several months with DWR Aquatics personnel in reviewing the proposed changes to the fishing regulations. We have voted unanimously to support the changes that we presented to your RAC this evening. One item that received a great deal of discussion was extending the possession limit to 2 days on selected waters. Some waters, Strawberry Reservoir, Fleming Gorge, and a few others, would remain with a possession limit of 1 day. This was acceptable to our coalition. Extending the possession limit to two or more days on these selected waters, or 3 days on the remainder, would have extremely negative impacts on the fisheries. The coalition encourages your RAC to support the division's proposal as presented. Thanks, Paul Dreeman.
Okay, well, we'll open it up to discussion by the RAC.
Well, I don't know. I know Paul Dreeman, and I would respect his opinion.
And so?
So I will move that we take accept the right. Utah Fishing Regulation Recommendations for 2014 as presented.
I have a motion by Wayne to accept as presented. Do we have a second?
I'll second it.
Seconded by Darris. Any discussion on the motion? All in favor, please raise your hand. All right, that was unanimous. The only other thing I have on here is field reservoir study.
I'm Justin Hart. I'm the Aquatic Program Manager for the Division of Wildlife in the Southeast Region. We thought this would be a good light agenda and a good time to kind of give everybody an update on Schofield. I'm just going to talk a little bit about where we've been recently and where we're headed. In 2005, we found Utah chubs in Schofield, and that picture there shows Utah chubs. They're very large minnows. They're extremely problematic in trout fisheries. They compete directly with chubs, and they're a big problem. That same year, we started stocking tiger trout in an effort to control them. Several years later, in 2009, we made some pretty big changes. We started stocking cutthroat again. Bear Lake cutthroat is a predator, which we hadn't done in a very long time in Schofield. And we also made a pretty drastic shift to the regulations. Schofield had, for many years, been a family fishery with just general statewide regulations, 4 fish limit, pretty simple. 2009 went to a slot limit on the cutthroat and the tiger trout, similar to strawberry and some other waters where we combat Utah chub. So some big changes were made recently at Schofield. Here's a figure of our Utah chub catch rates in our gill nets over the last 9 or 10 years. The y-axis there is the number of chubs we get on average per net. Bottom, of course, is years. If you look at the blue circles, those are catch rates from our spring netting data. And you can see in 2005 was the first year we found them. And there we got, I think it was like 2 point something per net, not very many. 2006, I think it went up to like 4. 2007, it jumped up to 40. Then you can see just exponentially increased into 2009, and we were up over 350 chubs per net in just 4 years. I mean, it was impressive how quickly they grew. From that point, you can see it's dropped somewhat. 2010 was really low in the spring, and I think it's because it was really, really cold, and we didn't catch many. But if you look at the next 3 years, 11, 12, and 13, you know, we're starting to see maybe a pattern of suppression. You know, 150 chubs per net is still quite a few chubs, but it's down. And the other color there is catch rates from our fall gill netting. Fall seems to be a better time to track chubs. The temperature is more stable. In the springtime, chub catches are affected greatly by temperature. If it's really cold, we're not going to catch a lot of chubs. And if it's really warm, the chubs are going to be up in the shallows spawning. So you have really high variability with spring data. Fall seems to be a bit better. You can see that is also declining somewhat. I'm really interested to see what we're going to get here in another month in 2013. But there seems to be some evidence that there might be some control or at least some suppression of Utah chubs in Schofield right now. And the red lines just kind of correspond to 2005 is when we started stocking tiger trout, and 2009 is the regulation change I just mentioned, and when we started stocking cutthroat. So let's look at this one. This is a figure of our rainbow trout catch rates in our spring gill nettings, represented as number per net. Historically, for the last 20, even 30 years really, trout catches at Schofield have averaged around 30 per net night. This is just rainbow trout, and you can see the pattern we've got going here. You know, 2005, 6, and 7, maybe even 8, we're kind of normal, you know, right around that 20 to 30 area, which is where we've historically been. And we've just nosedived from there. I mean, pretty systematically decreased through this spring to just several per net. And we haven't really changed stocking numbers much on rainbows. What I don't have on here are the catches for the other two trout species in Schofield, cutthroat and tigers. And while we have seen a drastic decrease in rainbows, if you look at trout as a whole, we're still in that 30 fish per net range with our trout catch at Schofield. It's just instead of it being dominated by rainbow trout like it used to be, it's now dominated by cutthroat and tiger trout. But I just wanted to show you what we've seen with our rainbows. And, you know, how come? Well, it's probably competition with chubs directly. They eat the same thing. And probably some competition potentially with the cutthroat and the tigers that are in there. So Drew kind of mentioned it a little bit in his slide. In 2011, we initiated a research project in cooperation with Utah State University. We have a master's student that's doing her thesis on a lot of questions regarding Schofield, primarily, can we control Utah chubs biologically? Here, pretty much, these five objectives kind of represent the questions we're asking. Number one, how does the food web operate in Schofield right now with the chubs? What are the constraints on fish performance? Number two, what is the size and condition of the predator population in the reservoir right now? Which species contribute the greatest or the least to predation? And from which cohort, at what size, at what age class do they start being useful to us in as being an effective predator? Number three, what are the preferred prey species? What kind of diet overlap are we getting that gets to competition? What are the predators' consumption rates on Utah chub and other prey species in the reservoir? And then number four is really the million-dollar question. Can the predator population limit the chubs, the prey population, through top-down control? In other words, can these predators control them and reduce their numbers greatly? And then are these three predators limited by interspecific competition with each other for the same resources? Now, I'm not going to address and provide data for all of these. I'm going to summarize pretty much just a couple things related to that real important question we have, number four. Can the predator population limit the prey, the chubs, in Schofield? Are you all familiar with hydroacoustics? It's basically boat-mounted sonar. And what you do is you take a boat and you drive around Schofield in a systematic zigzagging pattern, and you get hits on fish, just like a fish finder on a fishing boat. Based on those returns you get on the sonar, sometimes you can differentiate species just based on size of air bladder, morphology of the fish. And you can also differentiate size. At Schofield, you can tell the difference between a chub and a trout, but it's really hard to distinguish, is it a cutthroat, is it a rainbow, is it a tiger trout? So how that works is they can tell the size, but gill netting occurs pretty close to the time they do these hydroacoustics. And we can look at the distribution of trout we get in those gill nets, you know, 80% cutthroat, 20% tiger, 5% rainbow. And they can apply this hydroacoustic data to that sort of distribution of fish. So that's how these numbers are generated. If you look at August 2011, small and large, and that small and large essentially represents the time in a fish's life where he shifts to a more piscivory, he eats fish more. So at 350 millimeters, these trout shift to a fish diet, chubs. So if you look in a 2011 in August, the cutthroat population was estimated on for the small fish at about 40,000, large fish 175,000. You can see our rainbow numbers were down quite a bit. Small fish, there was about 40,000 estimated, large fish 15,000. And tigers were doing really well, especially for the large fish at 189,000. This survey with hydroacoustics was repeated in June of 2013. And you can see the estimates generated there. The top cutthroat, we had 80,000 of the small class size class fish and 340,000 of the large, which was quite an increase compared to 2 years ago. Rainbow, essentially non-existent. And that's just because the figure I showed you earlier, they're not in there anymore. They're not surviving. We're not seeing them. Tiger trout, a little bit more even distribution on size. So how do we use this? Based on what we find in fish stomachs and some other modeling they do on how efficient they can convert that food to energy, how fast they can digest things, we can estimate how many chubs are going to be eaten by a certain number of fish. So in that column, population size, that's based on the most recent, the June 2013 hydroacoustic population estimates. So let's look at cutthroat. The small cutthroat, the 80,000 of them, they're not quite as piscivorous yet as the larger size. They're eating about 250,000 estimated chubs. The larger cutthroat, the ones over 350 millimeters, eating 16 million chubs. Rainbow trout, you know, really, really non-significant, primarily because of their numbers, and also because rainbow trout aren't necessarily highly piscivorous like tiger trout and cutthroat. The tiger trout, you can see the smaller fish, the smaller age group, 350 millimeters and below, they eat a few chubs, 230,000, but the large ones, 8.5 million. So in total, we can say our population of trout is approximately 700,000. That includes both the size classes, the less piscivorous and the more piscivorous large fish. But they're eating 25 million chubs estimated annually. So let's boil this down. Prey consumption right now is estimated to be greater than the annual production of chubs in the reservoir. So we're eating more than is being produced. There is one caveat. Utah chubs can get pretty big. You know, they can get well over 10 inches. At Schofield, I think we've seen some in the 12-inch size. Trout can only eat a prey item approximately 30% of their own body length. So if you have a 10-inch chub, you need about a 30-inch trout to eat it. And there's 30-inch trout in Schofield. I mean, we've seen that. We've shattered the state records several times over the last year. But there's not a lake full of 30-inch fish. So what does that mean? It means that large chub aren't as susceptible to predation. They're probably not going to get eaten. They're going to get eaten by a few of the big fish, but not in high numbers. And also, those larger chubs are a lot more fecund. They lay a lot more eggs. And they can live a really long time. So it's going to take some time to whittle that population down through slow predation, lack of recruitment of small chubs coming up, and then just age and senescence of the older ones. So the place isn't unfortunately going to crash next week. It's going to take a little bit of time, but there seems to be some evidence that maybe we're headed in the right direction. So Utah State gave us some really, really good information. The report we got just recently was like 100 pages long, and it's extremely interesting. I've drastically simplified it, but I've picked a few things I wanted to highlight. I've shown evidence rainbow trout are providing very little return to our sport fishery. You know, we're stocking quite a few, the same as we really have for the last 10 years. We're not seeing them. We're not getting our money's worth. The anglers aren't seeing them. We're getting them back. And then rainbow trout are providing very limited predation. They're not predaceous really by nature, but and then there's so few of them in there. We're not getting any benefit from them from that aspect either. And the tigers and the cutthroat are doing their job very well. And maybe, I'm not going to say controlling, but suppressing the chubs, it appears. So, it's recommended by Utah State, based on this two-year-long survey, that we maintain our trout population in Schofield at no less than 320,000 trout, with an ideal composition of 75% tiger and 25% cutthroat. And I think probably we can play with the numbers and they're going to provide us some more information, but you know, we can probably get away with a different distribution if that's what people want. But I think it's important to realize tiger and cutthroat trout are doing the job we wanted them to do. So Drew kind of covered this a little bit. I just wanted to bring this rainbow figure back up and the drastic decreases in catches. You know, we've been noticing this for a few years. I think we've been hoping that maybe if the chub numbers went down, our rainbows would come back up. They don't seem to be. And we started asking ourselves a couple years ago, you know, are we better off with more predators in there and getting rid of the rainbows for a while? That's what kind of prompted this question. This is the specific question we asked on the online survey this year. Kind of explains that, you know, we're doing this study with Utah State. We're getting the results soon. You know, one of the things we asked Utah State to look at was what happens if we don't put rainbow in there and we increase our predator numbers, what would happen? So are people willing to live without rainbow trout for a period of time, 3 to 5 years, we said, with the goal being that we could maybe get rid of the chubs and avoid a rotenone treatment, which would be very, very costly. And also you'd lose the resource for probably 2 years realistically. And as Drew mentioned, 90% of the respondents were in favor of that, surprisingly. And at that time, we were only contemplating making this change if it appeared to be beneficial to the fishery and it would meet our management goals, which, you know, there seems to be potential for that. So just to summarize real quickly here, you know, I mentioned in 05, we found chubs, we stocked tiger trout. In 09, we started stocking cutthroat again. We changed the regulations. We implemented the slot limit, which was a big change. 2010, we got really serious. You know, we needed more information. We needed some help studying, and we got some funding and worked with Utah State and got this study planned. We also sat down with our chief and Drew and Paul and our regional guys, and we developed a timeline on Schofield. How are we going to attack this? What are we going to do? You know, let's have some sort of plan. So we figured the study would start in 2011. It would conclude in 2013, right now essentially. We needed to start thinking about a rotenone treatment. You know, what if we do need to treat the reservoir? We need to be prepared to do that. So we've looked into that. You know, we thought back then in 2010 that potentially 2014, 2015 might be a realistic time to do a rotenone treatment. You know, with the information we have now, maybe we need to increase our predator stocking. And then for 2015, we tentatively have a creel survey planned. And creel surveys are essentially annual surveys that give us really, really good information on how many angling hours we have, how many fish are people catching, and we can ask them questions related to their satisfaction, things of that nature. So that's what we've got planned, and that's what we've had planned for some time. This thing on the bottom here, this website, if you're interested, it's a blog post that Paul Birdsey wrote a couple years ago, back in 2011 or 10, kind of outlines what we're talking about here, you know, and it's a lot more detailed. It talks about the thought process we had regarding the management of Schofield and where we're headed and why, so if anybody's interested, it's there. And that's really all I have. Hopefully that kind of sheds some light on Schofield and hopefully where we're headed and where we've been. I will say, a lot of you probably know, but we've shattered the state record tiger trout out there three times in the last 2 years. This summer, some anglers caught one that was 19 pounds, 2 ounces, just enormous. And 3 years ago, the state record was 10 pounds. So, I mean, we've just blown the state record out of the water. It's impressive, the tiger trout that are coming out of Schofield. I think our cutthroats are coming, too. We're going to start seeing some pretty big ones here shortly.
Well, on the populations you showed, it looked like the cutthroat were doing better than the tiger. So are you planning on increasing stocking of tiger to bring it, those numbers up?
Yeah. Yeah, let's look at that there. Look at the numbers. You know, just let's look at cutthroat, the large. 330,000, 16 million eaten. And let's look at the large tiger trout, 130, 8 million. It's about a third less. Tiger trout compared to cutthroat, about half as many chubs eaten. So I think the tiger trout might eat more, if you want to look at it, more chubs per pound than cutthroat. Maybe because of their size, maybe because of their conversion efficiency when they eat. So there's just a lot more cutthroat in there. But I think tiger trout might be more effective if you boil it down to pound for pound. So I think that's where they came up with their recommendation.
To increase the number of
tigers to maximize our predation. But there's certainly room in there to, you know, change that, manipulate it around a little bit to still get where we want to be. If people don't want, you know, tiger trout are a little harder to catch for the average angler, you know. They don't hit power bait. And they're harder to catch, so cutthroat are a little bit easier to catch. So, you know, maybe we need to talk to the public about what they want to see if we're gonna go down this route. Or maybe they want to see more cutthroat, and I think there's a way we can probably make that just as effective.
Justin, how about, let's talk about Joel's Valley for a second then. Talk about how do the tiger muskies compare as a predator versus, say, these cutthroat and tiger trout. And are they doing the job? Are they getting rid of the chubs in Joel's Valley?
I don't know that we have an answer to that question yet. Are they doing it yet? We've approached Joel's Valley kind of conservatively. We didn't want to just swamp that place with tiger muskies and have it crash, you know, 4 years from now. We wanted to approach it slowly with a few tiger muskie and kind of see how it goes. And we've got big fish in there. They've been in there for several years, but I don't think we've seen Utah chub numbers go down much. I think we're going to start seeing it pretty soon, would be my guess. Are they a better predator? Probably. You know, one issue we have at Joe's Valley, escapement potential of fish in Joe's Valley Reservoir out of the reservoir. You know, it's possible, but it's a lot lower, you know, just because of that outlet structure, the overflow hole.
Yeah.
And we closely monitor that tailwater for escapement of tiger muskie, because there is concern that if whole bunches of tiger muskie get out and get down the San Rafael and into the Green, we could have some issues with our native fish. So we watch that very closely. Would it be nice to put tiger muskie in Schofield? Yeah. Would it work? It probably would. But the Schofield outlet is just a direct overflow apron.
Right.
And
okay,
when that thing overflows, you should see the fish that go over, especially the chubs the last couple of years. I mean, you can stand there and just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, you can count them hundreds by the minute. It'd be a problem to have hundreds and thousands of tiger muskies potentially get flushed down lower Fish Creek into the Price River, into the Green. So we're a little bit more limited with our management options at Schofield. To be real long-winded.
Has there been thoughts of putting tigers or cutthroats in Joel's Valley to help the tiger muskies?
Yeah, we tried tiger trout in Schofield Reservoir. In Joel's Valley. 07? Maybe it's 05.
They were in there in 03 or 04 was when they first went in.
Yeah, we tried them for several years, and we just didn't see them. I mean, we'd see a few here and there in our nettings, and that few would be caught. They looked miserable, you know. They just didn't return. Splake really are the only trout that have done well in there. So,
it's just to interject here for a moment. Interesting with tiger trout, what we're seeing is that they either do really well
very steep side, very limited shallow, flat, littoral areas. Whereas Schofield, maximum depth of 45 or 50 feet, it's got this extensive littoral area. It's highly productive, and the tiger trout seem to want to stay there. Joe Valley, what it seemed like they did was that they all ran out of Lowry water and Sealy Creek. They'd come back, and you can actually catch some nice tiger trout, but they're now 20, 21 inches. But it took them 5 years before they decided to come back to the reservoir. We're seeing the same thing in Causey Reservoir, Porcupine, and a number of other reservoirs that have got this similar type of shape. So I think it's a combination of what the inflow looks like and what the reservoir basin looks like.
Yeah, we don't see many tiger trout shows.
Go ahead, Dr. King.
Do I need to come up there?
You bet.
Mike King, just have a question. What's the cost comparison between the rotenone treatment, and I'm assuming you have to treat the whole lake, entire lake, compared to what it is to stock enough tiger trout and cutthroats?
I'm going to have to ask for some help on the trout numbers. But we've estimated a rotenone treatment could cost $750,000. In labor and chemical, and I don't even know what that might mean to loss in revenue, economy, the loss of the fishery for maybe at least a year.
That's not
realistically probably
restocking the place.
And then there's the cost of stocking it, which we'd want to stock large fish to jumpstart it, which large fish are extremely expensive. I might have to ask Paul or Drew to help me with how much it costs in the interim, just with our regular management.
So what you guys are asking is how much it costs to stock Schofield Reservoir annually? That's the question?
Is that the question?
Well, the question is the comparison. If you're going to kill them all with rotenone, then you got to do what Justin just said. But if you continue the stocking program to be effective, what's the cost in comparison?
Right.
Okay. For an effective stocking program?
Right now, to give you an idea, we stock 8-inch fish, I believe, in Schofield.
Let's say 300,000 subcatch.
300,000 8-inch fish. They're 4 to the pound. If someone has a calculator, they can probably help me out. So 300,000 divided by 4.
80,000
pounds times 3.5.
$250,000 a year. If we went with 320,000 8-inch fish. Not what we're stocking right now. What we're stocking right now is we're stocking 80,000 8-inch cutthroat and 120,000 5 to 6-inch tiger trout. 5-inch tiger trout are 20 per pound, so you have 120,000 of those divided by 5, which I don't know what it said, 8.
24.
Times $3.50 per pound. So that's what our current costs are. Now, it has been recommended that we increase that stock, which would increase the cost. But nonetheless, over the course of 5 to 6 years is when we're trying to project a control of the chubs. We might spend the same amount of money over that 5 to 6 years, but we would spend $1 million plus, you know, by the time we did the rotenone treatment and restocking, and we would have to go back in with a similar type of stocking program that we're currently contemplating, just because it's impossible to remove all the chubs even with a rotenone treatment. So we'd have to get in front of it and stock predators real heavy then too. So cost effectiveness, this is much more cost effective.
The best guess, Dr. King, is $84,000.
And 17 cents.
I think a real simple way to look at it would be it costs us $750,000 more to treat it, because we're still going to be stocking similar numbers, a similar composition. whether we treat it or we don't. We might increase it for a few years. That might cost a little bit more money, but you know, after the treatment, we're going to be coming back in with about the same thing. So
plus you lose a year,
and I don't know how to estimate what kind of loss we get to the economy. You know.
Well, there's longevity of the roadrunner treatment anyway. You know, if that's your plan, you're going to, you know, end up just doing a cycle of treatment every 8 or 10 years.
Do you treat it twice like you did with Ferris?
No, we probably just do it once on something this big. But we'd manage it the exact same way we're doing now. We'd probably want to keep a slot limit on. We'd want tigers and cutthroat, and hopefully we'll get some rainbow as a benefit out of the chubs gone. But we wouldn't be able to go back to just four fish, you know, because the chubs will come back probably at some point in the future, so we'd be right back into this. So if we can do this without treating, it'll save a lot of money.
You know, this is a very dramatic finding. This is important. This is far-reaching beyond Scoville. This, you know, we found out in the property that the cutthroat could control the chubs, but that was coupled with a treatment. This one's put on top of the existing and abundant chub population. That, I mean, this is an important finding here for our statewide fishery management program.
And if we're having just a general conversation right now, you know, we are in the, you know, we're moving right away from the road now as kind of a publicly acceptable method of treating reservoirs and streams anyway. And so this is very valuable to our future. And, you know, the hyper-striped bass program, you know, tiger muskies, we had a reservoir in southern Utah, Newcastle, that we could not manage with rainbow trout because of golden shiners. And if you've ever seen golden shiners, they'll just, you know, completely take over a fishery and eliminate survival sport fish. And we started stocking hyper-striped bass in there, and we haven't sampled a golden shiner now for 4 years. And so that's one where right now we're moving back into a realm where we could actually start managing with rainbow trout and without using chemicals and maintaining a trophy fish. It's really innovative and probably where we need to start looking in the future.
Can I ask one more dumb question?
You bet. There's no dumb questions.
See, I have to have a this is completely opposite of the industry. It's not opposite.
What kind of impact are pelicans having on chub populations? And you see any increases in pelican numbers in Schofield? It seems to me like that they, in the springtime, I've never seen so many as I saw up there this year.
I'll speak statewide. We have several studies going on right now with pelicans, specific to, you know, where they go, what they eat. I've had the unlucky task of doing stomach analysis for the past several years on pelicans. They eat a lot of chubs. They, you know, there was in the Strawberry Reservoir, there was an issue about, you know, what they eat and how they impact our trout fishery up there, and lo and behold, they eat chubs because chubs are most available. They're in the shallows, and that's where those pelicans forage. You know, they like to take the fish that are easiest and most abundant. Pelicans are increasing in abundance in Utah, as are, you know, cormorants and other piscivorous fish. Our opinion, at least what we've discussed, is probably because of our, you know, our sport fish management program. You know, we've dammed up mid elevation reservoirs, and it creates a real food source for those pelicans annually as they're moving south and then moving back north. And, you know, we're seeing impacts on our sport fishery in some. It's been documented in Minersville historically, and we actually have altered our rainbow stocking to alleviate the pressure that the pelicans and cormorants put on those fish and you know, stock them when those birds have migrated through.
Any other questions for Justin or Paul or Drew? All right, we stand adjourned.